Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Mike Hogan. I'm the president of the University of Illinois. Somewhere in the audience here is my counterpart and friend, Paula Alamirez, who's chancellor of the University of Illinois Champaign campus. Paula, are you somewhere where I can see you in the lights here? So would you please stand up and let us recognize you? There she is, right over there. I'm delighted on behalf of the university to welcome all of you to one of the largest and best campuses, the University of Illinois Chicago campus, in one of the world's largest and best cities. If you don't know it, UIC, as we call the University of Illinois and Chicago, is home to the nation's largest college of medicine and to the largest public health care facility in Illinois. Our Urbana campus, just a few hours south of here, is one of the world's premier public research universities, a global leader in programs ranging from engineering and business to agriculture and library sciences. But the excellence, and this was no surprise to you given the topic of the day, the excellence that five or six generations of Illinois men and women have built at the University of Illinois is now being threatened by the lingering aftershocks of the worst economic crisis the United States has suffered since the 1930s. The sour economy has left the state of Illinois with a massive budget deficit that has carved deeply into public financial support needed to operate our great university. The plan that will be outlined during today's summit, offers hope for a cure, creating a robust economy capable of supporting all of society's major needs. As you consider it, please remember that the University of Illinois is ready and a ready and willing incubator, not just for new ideas, but for the research breakthroughs that create new age jobs and opportunities. It won't surprise you to learn that virtually every plan talked about when we're discussing economic revitalization has a major research enterprise, a university research enterprise at the heart of it. And the University of Illinois already has a long legacy of serving communities we call neighbors as well as society in general. Our University of Illinois Chicago campus, for example, launched a Great Cities Initiative in 1993 that takes its programs into Chicago neighborhoods and couples education with service. The Urbana campus is a growing research park where more than 80 businesses work with faculty and students on collaborative business building research. The same is true of our Chicago campus. For nearly 150 years, job-creating breakthroughs ranging from healthcare to computer technology have traced their roots to the University of Illinois. More breakthroughs in all fields of science will follow next year when Blue Waters, one of the world's most powerful supercomputers, goes online at our Urbana campus. And the university is also perfectly positioned to lead discovery that experts say will help drive the nation's economy for the next generation in alternative energy sources, healthier food products, and processes to supplement dwindling water supplies. America's greatness and even its national security are now hinged tightly on its economic well-being and growth. I want to extend my deepest appreciation on behalf of the university to the Brookings Institution, the London School of Economics and Political Science, and the Alfred Herrhausen Society for their efforts to get the U.S. economy back on track. And I would be remiss not also to thank Chris Kennedy of Merchandise Mart, who's hosting the lunch that you'll be enjoying today. And he has, too, deep Illinois connections, University of Illinois connections, since he is, in fact, chairman of our Board of Trustees. Now it's my pleasure to introduce one of the hosts of today's summit. Strobe Talbott is president of the Brookings Institution, one of the nation's oldest and most respected public policy organizations. We were just reminiscing off stage here about a person we had in common. One of the original founders of the institution was also central to thinking through the Marshall Plan to help rebuild Europe after the Second World War, and I'm an author of a book on the Marshall Plan, so we had that name in common, and it's kind of an interesting thing to think about. Because now, over many, many years, there's been talk about a Marshall Plan Or the United States now, can you imagine that? So, anyway, Mr. Talbot joined the Brookings Institute in 2002 after a long and very distinguished career in journalism, government, and academic life. He's a former Deputy U.S. Secretary of State and founding director of the Yale Center for the Study of Globalization. His government and academic service followed an award-winning 21-year career as a diplomatic reporter and columnist at Time magazine, where his beats included Eastern Europe, the State Department, and the White House. He's the author of a dozen books and holds degrees from Yale and Oxford. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to the stage the leader of the Brookings Institute, Mr. Strobe Talbot.
Thanks, Mike, very much. And I'd like to echo Mike's thanks to Brookings's partners in this terrific event, the London School of Economics, Time magazine, which is an alma mater of mine, and of course the Alfred Herrhausen Society, whose chairman we will be hearing from in just a few minutes. But let me first, if I might, invoke the name, the terminology, and the vision of my friend and colleague at Brookings, Bruce Katz, who is the founding director of our Metropolitan Policy Program. Bruce has properly called this event a summit. That's the right word, since this meeting brings together leaders from around the world to survey the landscape of some of the most important issues of our time. Leaders who are here not only to discuss and analyze those issues, but who will, to the extent possible, close ranks behind some policy prescriptions that can be put into effect in the way that we govern ourselves as nations, and more to the point, in the way that we govern ourselves as metros. As many of you who have worked with Bruce know, he believes that we should think about what he calls the spatial geography of an economy that is metro-based. And it's in that spirit that I would suggest, even though we're calling this meeting a summit, we should think about the substance of what we're talking about, not in terms of a mountaintop, but in terms of the valley below, the heartland of our nations, where most of our citizens live, clustered in largely self-governing communities, and increasingly communities of communities, which is what the word metro means. It's in those communities in the valleys, at sea level, on river banks, and on the shores of Great Lakes, not on the distant peaks of national capitals, that many of the decisions are made and the initiatives taken that determine whether our economy is healthy, whether we're harnessing the upside of globalization by promoting export-driven growth, whether we're investing in innovation and infrastructure, whether we're fostering partnerships between elected officials and NGOs and between the private and public sectors, whether we're harnessing the research and thought leadership of our great universities like the University of Illinois to the public good, and crucially, whether we are stewarding our environment by making the transition to low and eventually no carbon sources of energy. Now, there's one more point that Bruce makes that is, I think, particularly germane today, and it has to do with an important difference between national and local politics. And this applies especially to the United States of America. Washington, D.C., Bruce's and my hometown, is still the capital of a great nation. It's the closest we have in this country to John Winthrop's vision nearly four centuries ago of a shining city on the hill. But it's not all that shining these days. Washington and Capitol Hill have fallen under a dark cloud of extreme partisanship and a breakdown in civility of discourse, which in turn have led to a breakdown in effective governance at the federal level, particularly when it comes to getting laws passed on anything like a bipartisan basis. That dysfunctionality is fortunately nowhere as severe in other parts of the country, notably in great cities like Chicago and in other cities whose mayors and officials are here today. The closer elected leaders are to their constituents, and when I say closer, I mean in Bruce's sense of spatially, physically closer, the less they can afford to engage in the slash and burn, take no prisoners polarization that has so afflicted politics and so hobbled policymaking and lawmaking in Washington. Hence, Bruce's concept of a pragmatic caucus of Republicans, Democrats, and independents who are getting things done in the city halls and city councils, the county commissions, and state legislatures around the country. That caucus is well represented by the Americans here today. So is the global dimension of the issues that we're discussing. Bruce likes to call America a metro nation. We're also a metro world. In that context, it's appropriate that we should now hear from Joseph Ackerman, the CEO of Deutsche Bank, who last night at dinner welcomed the participants as members of what he called the Urban Age family. In addition to being a towering figure in international business and finance, Dr. Ackerman also has standing in academe. He serves as a visiting professor at LSE. He's chairman of the nonprofit Alfred Herrhausen Society, which is the international forum of Deutsche Bank. Together with LSE, the Herrhausen Society organizes worldwide conferences like this one on the future of cities. I'm sure all of you join me in a sense of pride and gratitude that we can be part of the network that Joseph has been so instrumental in creating. So please join me in giving him a warm welcome.
Thank you very much, so, for your more charming introduction. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, Urban Age family members. I'm very pleased to be here, as I just learned, at the Metro Valley in Chicago. This valley, or this summit, as you call it now, is challenging us to address the question, how to deliver the next economy. I'd like to offer you my thoughts on how we could and should achieve that. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a time, we just heard a little bit about it, of tremendous economic uncertainty. We have been through the worst crisis in 80 years, and our situation, not only in the United States, but also in Europe, is still fragile. The world has been saved from depression thanks to extraordinary policy intervention. Here in the US, there are fears of a double-dip recession. In many parts of the developed world, Germany may be being a notable exception. Growth is weak at best, and the outlook for job growth and creation is uncertain. At the recent G20 summit in Seoul, the world's leaders agreed rebalancing is all important. We must tackle global imbalances between deficit and surplus countries, and national imbalances between the state and the private sector after 2 years of exceptional intervention and stimulus. It is absolutely imperative that we find the path to fiscal sustainability in the midterm if we want to restore the confidence of markets and investors around the world and achieve sustainable growth. If you look at public debt projections, it is clear how urgent this is. According to our baseline scenario, the public debt to GDP ratio in developed countries is predicted to soar to 133% in 2020, from around 100% right now. At the G20 Business Summit in Seoul, around 100 of the world CEOs came together to discuss how business can help stimulate sustainable growth. As part of that discussion, we spent a lot of time talking about green or low carbon growth. This relates to today's question, how do we deliver the next economy? There are many facets to that, ranging from the shifting geography of growth to shifts between industries. One thing is clear. The next economy must be cleaner and more energy efficient if we want to drive further global growth and at the same time keep our climate intact. This transformation will be nothing less than a new industrial revolution, a revolution that will change the way we live. More than anything, the new industrial revolution must transform the way we live in our cities. Urbanization is the defining trend of the early 21st century world. Deutsche Bank and its Alfred Herrhaus Society have led the way in studying the economic importance of cities with our series of urban age conferences. By 2050, around 70% of the world's population will live in cities, most of them in megacities. That's more than 6 billion people. And that means we need to make massive improvements in infrastructure. Transportation, buildings, power supply, water supply, it all needs to become much more resource efficient and energy efficient. At a time of fiscal stress, paying for these improvements is a big challenge. Today, I'd like to address three questions. First, why green growth is at the heart of a new industrial revolution, and in the near term, why it can help set us on the road to global economic recovery. Second, the race for leadership in energy technology. For private companies and for governments, what does it really take to win? Third, not unimportant, how do we pay for the next economy? What mechanisms do we use to finance the transformation we need? How can the public and private sectors work together to do this? Let me start by sharing with you how I see green growth at the heart of the new industrial revolution. Green growth is not only about combating climate change. Green growth is also a question of energy independence and therefore energy security, and in other words, national security. Green growth is also good economics. Energy efficiency makes sense. In mature economies, including the United States, it has already created thousands of jobs at a time when job creation is extremely important. In emerging markets, populations are growing and energy needs are increasing. This puts stress on conventional sources of energy. All of these considerations point in the same direction. Economizing on energy and other resources, developing alternative sources of energy, and limiting the environmental impact of economic activity. This involves a huge paradigm shift. We need to set up the infrastructure to deliver low-carbon energy. We must also restructure the supply chains which deliver conventional high-carbon energy. This will take innovation, leadership, perseverance, and undoubtedly time and patience. But our actions can also have an impact in the near term. Providing low-carbon energy is a business which will triple in size over the next 10 years. By some estimates, it could be worth around $2 trillion by 2020. All around the world, companies are sensing the opportunity, investing in it, and capturing leadership positions in new technologies. And governments are creating incentives for them to do so. The recent crisis has turned out to be a catalyst for for action. Globally, around $500 billion has been set aside for green stimulus spending. In China, green stimulus accounted for 40% of total stimulus spending in the years 2008 and 2009. In South Korea, the figure was 80%. Clean energy investment in Asia as a whole rose 37% in 2009. Here in the US, the Recovery Act included $90 billion of green stimulus spending. So far, around $20 billion has been spent. That created 190,000 additional jobs. Short-term spending measures can be useful as shock absorbers after crisis. But ladies and gentlemen, they are not the only answer. The real key lies in a clear long-term strategy of transition. Delivering the next economy will involve significant investment. And investors are looking for a policy framework that delivers on three accounts. It must be transparent, it must be long-term, and it must be certain. Let me turn to my second question. Who wins the race for leadership? Before we talk about the players, let's first take a look at the playing field. Last year, according to the International Energy Agency, subsidies for renewable energy amounted to around $57 billion. But we spent around $320 billion globally on subsidizing fossil fuels. That's $6 on subsidizing the old paradigm for every dollar we invest in the new. We should correct this imbalance, as the G20 recommended last month. To create a coherent alternative energy policy, there is one essential first step. We must establish a price for carbon. The world needs an estimated $45 trillion of investment in clean energy between now and 2050. If we are to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius only. Last month, an advisory group of finance ministers and some private sector experts, including a senior representative from our bank, delivered its report to the United Nations. The experts concluded that unless we have a carbon price of at least $25 per ton, it will be difficult to raise the $100 billion per year in funding for emerging economies, which was promised by industrialized nations in Copenhagen last year. There are several ways to price carbon. In Europe, it's explicit via the cap and trade system. But carbon is also implicitly priced by official standards, for vehicles and buildings in particular. Here in the United States, for example, fuel economy standards for cars were raised, and that has reduced carbon emissions per mile by 14% in the last 5 years. And then there are so-called feed-in tariffs. These have been very influential in accelerating the development of wind and solar power. In Germany, the feed-in tariff has helped create a $30 billion renewable energy industry and 300,000 jobs in a few years. Now let me turn from the playing field to the players. China has established itself as a world leader in green technology. It is now number 2 in wind power, with 22 gigawatts of installed capacity in 2009, enough to power about 17 million homes. China is the world's largest manufacturer of wind turbines and solar panels, and is fast growing in battery technology and electric cars. China has the potential to become a major manufacturing hub for electric vehicles. Already, there are 120 million electric bicycles on Chinese roads. Last month, I was in Beijing. The message I got from every quarter was very clear. China is determined to be a winner in the race for energy technology leadership. China's leaders see green growth as an integral part of the country's future growth story, an essential element of China's energy security. They plan to invest $750 billion in the next decade. In China, green growth will shape the next economy. The United States has the potential to be a winner in energy technology and lead the world as it has in so many other areas. But to do that, the U.S. must make bold decisions and commitments, and soon, so as to avoid falling behind. I have strong faith in the entrepreneurial and innovative spirit of this great nation. The United States can seize this opportunity. Make no mistake, a new world order is emerging. The race for leadership has already begun. For the winners, the rewards are clear. Innovation and investment in clean energy technology will stimulate green growth, it will create jobs, it will bring greater energy independence and national security. The private sector does not need to wait for agreements between the world's political leaders. Examples of the private sector in action are there to see. Desertec, to name just one, is a private sector project in which Deutsche Bank is invested. This initiative involves unique collaboration between North African, Middle Eastern, and European partners. We aim to harness the potential of wind farms and solar power plants in the Sahara Desert. This could produce up to 15% of Europe's electricity by 2050. The people of North Africa will gain new access to energy. The project will stimulate the economy of the Mediterranean region. It's ambitious. It is even bold. But it will provide benefits for all involved. This brings me to my third question. How do we pay for the transition to the next economy? Here I see three imperatives. First, public and private sectors must come together to finance the investments that green growth needs. Second, this commitment involves sharing the risks. And third, carbon markets need to be developed a lot further. There's a huge potential for private investment in green growth if we create the right environment for investors. The UN Advisory Group, I already mentioned, estimates that private investment developing nations could grow to $400 billion per year by 2020. About half of that would come from foreign investors. But there are barriers to the investment. Startups face challenges. Domestic capital markets, some nations are still underdeveloped. Some do not cater for inflows of foreign capital. Technology can be risky. These barriers to investment need to be removed. The public and private sectors need to work together to provide financing and assume risk. The U.S. Department of Energy Loan Guarantee Program is a good example. Public money is tight, so it's important to make public spending go as far as possible and leverage the multiples provided by private sector finance if you can. In Germany, the government recently set up the Global Climate Partnership Fund together with the country's development bank, KfW. The government and KfW will put in around $70 million, including first loss equity capital. This will leverage at least $500 million of joint public and private investment. Together, the government and private investors will finance renewable energy projects in small businesses and private households in 13 developing countries. But the most effective way to kickstart private investment is to develop robust carbon markets. Even in Europe, these markets are still small. We need to scale them up. To do that, the design of these markets needs to be reformed and more nations need to adopt carbon constraints. Both China, in the city of Tianjin, and Brazil, in the city of Sao Paulo, are taking a lead here. They want to use carbon markets to manage their carbon footprint. We now have 6 years' experience of emissions trading in Europe. Based on that experience, carbon markets need to develop in two ways. First, as in other asset markets, mechanisms need to be established that ensure a stable market environment, where market integrity is ensured and price disruptions are avoided. Second, emissions trading systems need to be stable enough to generate forward prices with a time horizon of at least 7 to 10 years. Green growth requires long-term investment. We need a market that allows investors to hedge that long-term investment. Ladies and gentlemen, the potential for investment is huge. But investors have choices. Investors want to see consistency, transparency, and longevity in the markets they invest in. That's true for any well-functioning market, and carbon markets are no exception. Before I conclude, allow me to say a few personal words. Some of you may be asking yourselves, why does a bank CEO spend time thinking about green growth? I'll give you two reasons. First, because it's an exciting business opportunity. Climate change and energy usage are becoming ever more important topics for our clients. Deutsche Bank's profile is ideally suited to serve our clients in this area. We are leaders in capital raising, asset financing, trading and risk mitigation in some of the world's most complex markets. We are very large asset managers. We are present on the ground in every significant emerging market. We are uniquely placed to accompany and advise our clients, governments, private sector companies, and investors who are involved in delivering the next economy. And if we perform for our clients, we'll perform for our stakeholders and shareholders. My aim is to keep Deutsche Bank at the forefront of green growth. Second, because we can all play a part in using energy responsibly. As I speak, nearly 3,000 of my Deutsche Bank colleagues are in the process of moving back into our headquarters in Frankfurt. We spent 2 years and more than 200 million euros turning it into one of the most resource-efficient and energy-efficient office buildings in Europe. We radically changed the way we use power and water and increased the proportion of our energy which comes from renewable resources. Result, we reduced the carbon footprint of the building by 89%. Our goal is for Deutsche Bank to be carbon neutral by 2012. As we deliver the next economy, I want Deutsche Bank to be a leader, not only in the way we serve our clients, but also in the way we conduct ourselves and serve society as a whole. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let me conclude. The challenge is huge. So it's the opportunity. We can transform the way we use energy in our companies, our cars, our homes, and elsewhere. We can create new industries. We can create new jobs. We can safeguard and even increase the independence and security of our nations in questions relating to energy supply. The costs of this transformation are considerable. Investing $45 trillion globally by 2050, that's a big ask. But the costs of doing nothing are much higher. We in the financial industry must play our part. And it cannot be financed on bank balance sheets alone. We must come up with new ways of financing green growth. We can form alliances across banking, insurance, and fund management to connect investors with innovators. We can help connect government funding with private capital. And we must work with regulators and each other to develop efficient, transparent, and robust energy trading markets around the world. We will only succeed if we work together. Nations must collaborate with each other. The public sector and the private sector must work together. We must share the burden of financial commitments, and we must share the risk. But above all, let us share a vision of the mutual benefits of succeeding. This really could be a second industrial revolution. Let's go to work on delivering the next economy. Thank you and have a good day.